Hey, Bobby Manning here with Dome Theory. We have an awesome episode for you today. We're talking to James Edwards III from The Athletic. Celtics and Pistons obviously played a really fun series in a double back-to-back fashion as they're doing this season. We obviously did an episode on the Pacers last week. Got to see them for two games. Looks like it's going to be one of the better teams in the Eastern Conference, even with TJ Warren going down this week. So check out Caitlin Cooper talking about them and the Celtics last week. Some Miles Turner discussion there continues. He's off to an awesome start this year on the defensive side of the ball, which is key. So Pistons take the first game, ton of pace, a million turnovers between the two teams, and shining first half performances from Jeremy Grant, who people forget went to Syracuse. It was, you know, the third option there, slasher, cutter, diving big man. He has completely transformed his game since getting drafted by Philadelphia, heading over to the Oklahoma City Thunder, where he became a great stretch four, help defender, shot blocker, all those things there, carved out his body, and then ends up on a Denver team as the Thunder tried to break apart their roster 2 years ago and only continue to grow with the Nuggets on their way to the West Finals, and then shocked everybody by joining the Detroit Pistons, who seemingly were just becoming one of the middling teams without any eye into the future. They just had such an odd roster. Blake Griffin, injury riddled, Andre Drummond making big bucks playing the middle there. They didn't have much of a eye into the future, is all you can say about it. Like, they were just a middling team that didn't have much going for them without a direction. And now, four good draft picks to start this year. I know Killian Hayes is about to miss 4 to 6 weeks, but I was impressed by Sadiq Bey, Isaiah Stewart, certainly, a guy that I wish the Celtics had taken a longer look at. I had them taking him in my mock draft. And I was impressed by their compete. They're not going to be a good team this year. We know that. But Jeremy Grant looks like he's ready to take that first option. Through the first three games this year, before that Boston series, he was shooting 47% on 17 attempts a game. That's impressive. They didn't play the best schedule at that point. Golden State, Cleveland, the likes. And they had lost those games, obviously. They're not going to be great this year, but if they get a good draft pick, if they nail it, if they continue to develop these young players, show patience, that Mason Plumlee signing looks decent so far. I've been proven wrong on them in the Bulls as well. Looking good. Beating Portland last night. I'm probably going to be wrong about Portland. I know it's less than 10 games, but that defense is almost rock bottom in the NBA. And shout out to Kevin O'Connor, who was on top of that one. Our former friend of the show, Lindo Zay, I texted him before the Pistons series started, before the Bulls game last night, was like, these teams just look so dreadful. Like, should there be relegation in the NBA? That's something we've talked about a lot with some of these horrendous rosters, teams that make poor signings and just get muddled up in the middle and should almost be leading the group of bad teams in a lower NBA division. Well, they both look good. They both seem to have futures with good coaches and Dwayne Casey and Billy Donovan, and scoring some important victories early this year. Now, they're not going to be in the playoff races. They're certainly going to be vying for number one pick again. But now we talk about Patrick Williams, Killian Hayes. Look like they're going to be good players for these teams to work with into the future, and then facing an even better NBA draft this year. Shout out to them. But that's not what we're talking about today. We are getting into Grant's decision. A lot of people ask this over the offseason. Why would Jeremy Grant leave the Nuggets, a contending team, for the same money to go to the Pistons, to Detroit, all that stuff? Edwards got an answer on it, and it was beyond basketball. So he's going to reveal to us today why Jeremy Grant chose the Pistons and why he could possibly inspire other players to head in that direction in the future. It's one of the best stories in the sports world to start 2021. I accidentally found out about it as I was DMing him to come on the show after that Pistons series. And thankfully, I got a good preview of it here before it came out this morning. Check it out on The Athletic. He writes and covers the Pistons for them. And check out our Celtics coverage tonight. Celtics Heat on ESPN. You'll be able to watch that game and then tune in with us after on Celtics postgame. Also, MF Doom, New Year's Eve, passed away, 49. He actually died on Halloween, and the news didn't come out at all, not even a murmuring of it, for 2 months, which is amazing in today's news climate and befitting of an artist who was able to avoid the way music was heading into 2000s, carve out his own lane, and become his own mysterious figure in the rap world that's almost never going to be replicated again with social media and all the other direct access we have to artists today and the amount of artists that are out there now competing for space, attention. Unless you're Frank Ocean or SZA and you have that landmark album that's going to carry people's attention for years to come, you can't get by without calling attention to yourself. And Doom obviously was from the 80s, from the 90s, and was able to do it a different way where he had a character, a mystique. I know Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a couple years back about the mystique of Kanye West and MF Doom and these figures, the last figures in the music world that had sort of this legend attached to them that preceded their actual personalities and who they were as people. So we'll talk about MF Doom at the end of the show. We'll start with some film. You can check out these film segments on YouTube in the full version of the show that's up on CLNS Media and my own YouTube account, Bobby Manning. We're doing film breakdowns throughout the year. All this stuff is important. Short intro today. Got a ton of stuff going on today, so let's get right to it. James Edwards III is with us here on Dome Theory. Subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, all the places you get your podcasts. We are, as well as CLNSmedia.com. I'll talk to you after the game tonight, and here's James. Here he is, James Edwards III with us here from The Athletic. You can read him over at theathletic.com as you can. Many good friends of Dome Theory here. Welcome to another episode of Dome Theory. James, great to meet you. Great to have you here. We're going to do some film right off the bat. You ready?
Yeah. No, I appreciate you having me on, man. Thanks. Nice to meet you as well.
All right. We had Friday game, Sunday game between the Celtics, between the Pistons, and two phenomenal endings. Honestly, in this season of blowouts and just everybody being 500 across the league, it feels like these have been two of the better games we've watched all year with the pace. Got messy in both those games with the turnovers, yeah. Everything like that. But we had two phenomenal endings here. So we're going to get into this film a little bit. Going to pop you up on the screen here. Hope this technology works. And this was from Friday where the Celtics ended 0-for-9 from the field. And it feels like the Pistons were kind of going overload in the box. We're seeing a lot of teams do this year, where teams are just kind of packing the paint. Have you seen this a lot from the Pistons? Is this something they've been running all year with this like overload in the paint on, I believe it was Tatum here on this first play?
Yeah, I think they have done it a lot, especially on against guys of Tatum's ilk. I'm trying to remember this play.
This was the first one here. Now, this one actually wasn't the overload. This is kind of like a flare screen for Tatum here. Right. I believe the second one here for Brown, which could have been the game tire, I believe, here at 96-93.
I think I remember this one.
Was where they overload the box here.
Yeah, I think they have done that against guys. Oh, this was his chance to win it. Yeah. They have done that against guys like those. They were very aggressive in guarding Trae Young a few nights ago. Same with Steph, obviously. The perimeter defense has been bad at times, has been good at times. Casey's still figuring out defensively his best lineups. It's starting to show a little bit more. I think the Boston game helped, even though I wouldn't say last night was the most defensive game of the season. But that's some stuff that they definitely have done so far this year.
Then we get in the Sunday night, a little more of the same here. You know, overload on that Tatum side, and Brown ends up wide open on this one again. If it felt like similar plays to me, more the flare stuff on the Friday that gets Brown and Tatum open at the end of the game. But this one, I mean, you can see Brown why he's scoring
close to 30 points a game, shooting close to 60%. Just the amount of pressure that Tatum gets on the perimeter, on his drives, on the pick and roll, all that kind of stuff.
Teams are making him show that he's a playmaker, and I think he did that well in the two games against Detroit. I think he moved the ball well. I think he, in terms of attacking, there were times where he's maybe a little too meticulous and try to be a little too methodical to get his own shot. But I think in terms of creating for others, I thought he made a lot of right decisions in both games.
Now, Detroit, they go back and tie the game here with about 3 seconds left. And, you know, Celtics have played seven games. Feels like they've had about four opportunities for Jason Tatum to get a game winner through seven of those. And he's actually cashed in on two now with this one here on Blake Griffin. Ends up D'ing him up one-on-one here and just gets torched off the three-point line. Blake hasn't looked great to start this year athletically. I mean, definitely a step back, playing more of a perimeter game, more ground-bound than we ever could have imagined. What are you seeing from him early this year?
I mean, pretty much what you just described. I think one thing people forget, too. And I mean, it could be this is just what happens after many leg injuries and getting up there in age. But Blake literally didn't play for a year. His last game last year was late December. Obviously couldn't play 5-on-5 as most players, as all pretty much all players couldn't during the pandemic. So I do wonder if maybe there's a chance that he looks a little more mobile as the season goes on. Maybe not, because the NBA season does bring wear and tear. But he hasn't played in a while. He has relied heavily on his three ball, which he's shooting well. I mean, 41%, which is pretty much spearheaded by an 8-of-16 performance against the Cavs a few nights ago. I think actually not a few nights ago, last week or a week and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you don't see he's not getting off the ground like he used to. He's more passive, definitely playing a lot of 3-point line to 3-point line. He hasn't played in a long time. So I'm curious to see, if this changes at all in the next week or two, now that he's gotten kind of shaking some rust off.
It's a great play here, too. It kind of looks like Grant was on him initially. You know, that's kind of what the Pistons would want there. And then it's just a quick dive from Tice, screen and pop up from Tatum there. And Blake ends up on him all alone. And, like, at the last second, you can see Grant kind of come in here and want to come in and get that double, but it's just way too late about the left elbow there. And it's a great shot from Tatum to close it. So we're talking 1-5 for the Pistons now. Not a great start for them. We knew it'd kind of be awkward with some of the personnel that they have in there. I mean, Jeremy Grant's looked good to start the year. But where are you seeing this team at through the start of the season?
I mean, it's exactly what I expected. I think it's exactly what the front office expected. Their goal coming into this year was to be competitive, but still build for the future. And if I know, probably a lot of your audience is just focused on the Boston game and might not be aware of what Detroit has done up until then. But I mean, against Minnesota to open the season, they were up 8 late and lost it. Against Cleveland, they were up and lost it. They've really only lost one game, like kind of definitively. And even that game, they came back, and that was Atlanta, who once had an 18-point lead in the game and Detroit got it down. I don't think they tied it, but it was within 6 points at a point.
Yeah.
So they heading into the Boston series, which is weird to say. Heading into the two
I love it though. Isn't it great? Like you can kind of just like dive into two teams here.
Yeah, and I think it showed in the Sunday night game. But yeah, like they had lost all their games by, if you average it out, less than 10 points. I think it was like 9.2. Aside from the game they won, and then they beat Boston and then lose to Boston on a game winner. So they've been in every single game that they've played. They just haven't been able to close it out.
That's funny too, because I was doing some YouTube titles yesterday. I'm going to talk about some SEO here. I don't know how old you are. I'm 22. How old are you?
I'm 28.
So, you know, we're both kind of out of that age range when the Pistons and Celtics used to battle in the 80s. And, yeah, you know, I write Celtics Pistons game two in the title, and it just explodes because I guess it was a huge game two between Bird and Isaiah back in the day. And, you know, you go back and watch some of those YouTube clips. But yeah, we have series now. It was really fun following the Pistons, the Celtics for both of these games. We'll get to a little more of that series. But I want to talk about your journey now to the Athletic a little bit. You know, you've been working in the Detroit area for a little while now, covering sports, high school, college, now the pros. Grew up in Flint. What led you toward the sports media game?
Yeah. So it was, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's a normal story, but like my dad played like junior college basketball, and my mom played soccer, and like obviously, like any kid, I'm sure all of us and everybody listening wanted to be in the pros, but they always said had a plan, have a plan B, in like third grade. So we always had sports on in the house. We always had ESPN magazine. We always had newspapers. So I was like, what's the next best way to get into the league? And it was journalism or broadcasting. And ended up, once I got to college, went to Michigan State, ended up majoring in sports journalism and taking the writing route. And worked in Lansing covering high school and Michigan State sports for 2 years. And then the Athletic called in 2017, and I've been covering the Pistons since. Yeah, it's kind of weird because seeing where the company is now, and I'm still, I mean, relatively young, at 28, but like I was one of the first, let's say, 30 employees, 45 employees, just because Detroit was the third or fourth city, and I got in at the ground floor. So, yeah, man, it's been wild. I feel like a vet, but, I mean, yeah, I'm not even 30 yet.
How have you kind of seen that it's huge now? Like, the amount of people, my good friend Matt covers Syracuse for them. You know, I went to Syracuse with him and worked with him, and now he's kind of doing the whole coverage for them. We've got a couple of great writers on the Celtics side, you know, as you know, Jay King and all of them. It's just ginormous. And you talked about being one of the first employees there. I remember hearing about it when it first started, and they were talking about, you know, we're bringing back the back of the sports page and, you know, bringing in some great writers and just investing the amount of money on doing like deeper stories, you know, profiles, you know, more stuff beyond the games. And how have you seen that grow over the last couple of years that you've been there?
Yeah, like, I think people were always hesitant about the subscription model back then. But if you look now, there's no service pretty much on earth that doesn't require a subscription. And that was just always going to be the way that, that things went, as these companies tried to learn how to monetize this new digital world. And I think people are always willing to pay for good, thoughtful, in-depth content as long as they feel like they're getting a bang for their buck. And not to say that other publications don't do that. But I think The Athletic, because there are no newspapers, there's not a reliance on getting something out the next day, or there's not a reliance on necessarily clicks. We don't have to have three stories in one night. We don't have to have something that caters to the people who still get hard copies. Like, we can take our time and do in-depth stories that, I mean, yeah, like, I always look at it like this. Like, I can do on Twitter with a few tweets what some people might use as their story. Mm-hmm. And that's just the nature of the business and what we do. And then there's stuff that I think I'm able to do in story form that others aren't able to do just because of time. And I think it's a good balance. I think there's a world for everybody to kind of to live in. I think there are people who are maybe more casual fans that just wanted to see what's going on that day with a certain team. And there are some people who want to know like inside baseball stuff. So I think this world we can all live in and thrive in. But there's definitely different avenues, and I'm not surprised that The Athletic has had the success it has, because, I mean, like you said, like, there's so many great writers doing great stuff, and people are learning more about their teams and the players they follow than I think ever before. And I think The Athletic has played a big part in that.
Now, you've had a good story come out on Jerami Grant making his road to the Pistons. I see you got another one coming.
The wrong message. Is actually supposed to go to, we have a Athletic beat writer DM thing And since you had DM'd me last, and that one's usually up top, it was late after the game, and I hit the wrong button.
That's great, because you know I do my research. You know, yeah. I dig deep. I never would have known that was coming, but I can't wait to preview that story a little bit here. But that's the kind of stuff you try to do to, you know, set apart the Athletics coverage a little bit is, you know, like a story like that on why Jeremy Grant would make this decision. That was honestly one of the big questions of the offseason. You know, Denver just made the Western Conference Finals. He had grown so much there. He seemed like the perfect kind of third, fourth option on a team, given his shooting, given his help defense, all that stuff. But no, he takes the same amount of money, goes to Detroit, becomes pretty much the first option in Detroit. And you dove a little bit into why he made that decision, some of the motivating factors, some of the stuff off the court that would lead him in that direction. So give us a little preview of what we're going to read there.
Is this coming out tomorrow, this pod, or today?
This is today.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the story's not coming out till tomorrow. Let's just say I had a chance to, in this world, this current media world where it's tough to get one-on-ones with players. I was able to get one with Jeremy Grant, and yes, the bigger role, the ability to grow as a player was a motivating factor in coming to Detroit. But I will say that, and while that has been kind of the public push of why he's come here, there's other underlying reasons that he has not yet discussed that will that really motivated his reasoning for coming to Detroit. And the story that's coming tomorrow, we'll get into those. I think it's a first of its kind in terms of a player admitting these reasons as why he came to Detroit. I can't think of many who have. I'm being very vague, but I think people will understand when they see it tomorrow.
All right. Well, this is what we're going to do right here. Since I have the keys in front of me, I got the ability to make all this happen. I hope you trust me here, but we're going to cut this part out. We're going to use as a segment tomorrow after the article comes out, and we'll just leave everything else here because the Pistons Celtics played on Sunday. Celtics got another game tonight. So we'll leave all this stuff. We'll cut this part out and put it on tomorrow. And I'm just curious. I just want to hear this before everybody else. This is selfish for me, but you know, what'd you get into with him?
Yeah, basketball fans are familiar with how Jeremy was at the forefront of kind of social justice and racial inequality in the bubble. He was the first one to every question that he got. He brought back to Breonna Taylor. And I had heard through the grapevine that part of the reason he wanted to come to Detroit was he wanted to play for black men in leadership positions. And you look at Detroit, Dwayne Casey's the head coach, and Troy Weaver is the GM. And it's no coincidence that Detroit is the blackest city in America. So we dove into that and why that was why having black men in leadership positions was important for him. He's a guy who's been in the league 7 years now and has never played for a black coach.
Mm-hmm. And is that kind of what the Pistons are building here a little bit in terms of, you know, the leadership structure from Troy Weaver, Dwayne Casey? You know, he's had a phenomenal run in Toronto, you know, no championship, but, you know, a guy that you can trust as a head coach, I think, has done a good job in a couple of different stops now. And then, you know, Jeremy Grant, what does he kind of see himself as with in terms of a number one option in your conversations with him?
Yeah, I think one thing I asked him is when people saw the news that he would go leave Detroit or leave Denver for Detroit, you could see like the common fan be like, oh, he's just chasing stats. Like it's selfish. And I asked him, I'm like, why do you think people have that view? He's like, I don't think fans can understand it, but players can understand it. Players understand wanting to be the best version of yourself as a player as you can be. And I think fans just look at it as I just walked away from a situation where I would win. And I get it. Like, you only get a short amount of time to play in this craft. And Jeremy, you look back at his history, even going back to high school, he's never been considered the best player on his team. In high school, he played with Victor Oladipo, his brother Jerian, and Quinn Cook. In college, he was with C.J. Fair. Tyler Ennis. And then, I mean, in the NBA, we all know he's never been considered the best player on his team. So I get it. Like, you only get to play this game for so long. You want to find out what you're made of. You want to find out what you can do. And if you can go and help build a organization back from the ground up and still have and do it in a way that fulfills some of your other objectives as a human and as a man, totally understand it. And I think the story that's going to come out will make a little bit more sense for those who question Jeremy's decision, because it's the other part of his decision aside from basketball can't be written into a contract or quantified with minutes logged and shots taken.
I love that, and I appreciate you giving us the teaser there. I want to stay on Grant because this isn't a Syracuse podcast, but we're Syracuse adjacent. You know, we started the show in Syracuse. We talk a lot about Syracuse because it's just one of the things I love. It's amazing to see what he's become from those days that you mentioned at Hughes, because if you look back at him as a player at Syracuse, probably the third option on that team as well, you know, kind of a slasher diver, and didn't have the shot that he does now, the dribble that he has now, the passing ability, all these things he's added. Even as a defender, he's completely transformed. As a body, like, you know, his body's transformed as well. Like, you wouldn't even recognize him looking at him today and comparing that to where he was at Syracuse. And if you were ranking the Syracuse players since Carmelo Anthony in 2003 that have come out to the NBA, I mean, he's number one by far at this point in terms of what he's done. You know, about 17 shots a game coming into this Detroit-Boston series, shooting 47% coming into the series on that volume was pretty impressive to me. Had a pretty good series, rougher second half. The first halves were really good in both those games. But what are you seeing from him?
That one possession where you missed four threes doesn't help. Was that Friday? I think they got like four offensive rebounds or three, and he like missed all.
Yeah, and he started that. I think he was 4-4 from three to start that first game. He was just on fire. And then, you know, and that's kind of what you have there. You got Derrick Rose as a second ball handler, but there's a lot riding on Grant right now, the way Griffin looks.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing so far from him as that?
But yeah, to your question, what have I seen?
Yeah.
I think one thing I didn't necessarily anticipate coming was for him to create his own shot, I just didn't think he had the handle to do it. But what I've noticed is he is so long. Like, one, two dribbles, he can kind of slime his way through guys. He can step around them. Like, and then his arms are so long, he's at the basket immediately. Like, his length kind of nullifies his lack of tight handle. He's a better ball handler than I anticipated, but he's not he's not a Kyrie Irving. He's not a Jason Tatum or even a Jaylen Brown handling the rock, but he's so long that he can get past guys. He can jump. Like, he's just perfectly built to get his shot off without having the type of necessarily refined skill that others have. And I think that's been, if you ask Pistons fans, what's really surprised them is his ability to get to the hole in one or two dribbles from the 3-point line. I think he's finished pretty well. I think a lot of times he's gotten fouled and hasn't really been called, and that maybe comes with more. If you ask Detroit fans, they don't get calls anyway.
Maybe an all-star appearance will do that.
I think that's
going to
come with for Jeremy. you don't know how things are called, but. Yeah, I think that's been the most impressive thing for me, his ability to get to the hole using not over dribbling. I do think he needs to kick out some. I think his efficiency would be even better if he just a little more kicked it to the corner a little more instead of forcing up a tough shot. But, I mean, he's made a good amount of them, so he's getting there. Defensively, he's been doing what he does. But yeah, I think his ability to get to the hole is probably what surprised most people.
So, you know, you grew up in Detroit, probably a Pistons fan growing up. You got a pretty historic franchise there, great players, Wallace, you know, a team that kind of reflects the city to some degree when you look back on some of the championship teams that they've had there. I think one of the interesting things, and I think I heard Bill Simmons talk about this on his podcast yesterday with you know, talking about the Bills and Stephon Diggs coming in and him having this great season. But you know, Buffalo, the city, not going to interact with him in the stadium, even with the great year he's had. So you don't have that direct fan player connection in the stadium. And I see you at these games, empty crowds, of course, in Detroit, probably for most of the season, as Jeremy Grant makes his Detroit debut. And you talk a lot about, you know, the connection between him and the city that he's trying to form here. How do you think Detroit fans are going to ultimately connect with him? And how do you think he's going to kind of interact with the city, the fan base, what the Pistons are and what they're building?
It's a good question. I actually, like, so I grew up in a Pistons family. I was actually, I'm from Flint, which is just an hour and a half. The people know Miles Bridges, Flintstones, Monty Morris, JaVale McGee, all from Flint. But I actually grew up a Clippers fan. That was, for some reason, I gravitated towards Sean Livingston and Chris Kaman.
That's a weird one.
yeah. No, I liked Chris Kaman. Went to Central Michigan, so I got to see him play a lot. And then Sean Livingston, everyone compared him to Magic Johnson. And being a Michigan State guy, like, I just gravitated toward that.
Yeah.
But I know what the city, I mean, I know what the city likes to see. I know what the city appreciates in its basketball teams. And I think this the message is clear. I think there are some fans who think that this team's trying to chase the eighth seed again. I don't think those are necessarily the most in tune fans, I would say. Like, it's your casual fan. And that's the fan that's probably most likely to go buy a ticket. But if they're able to compete, that was my question coming into the Boston series. Boston's record wasn't as good as I think the Celtics are.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious if Detroit could play competitive with a team like that. And so we have the full spectrum where they're playing tough against the Clevelands and Minnesotas of the world, but they're also playing tough against the Celtics of the world. And I think if they're able to consistently do that when fans return, I think the city will get behind them because they'll look out there, they'll see 19-year-old Killian Hayes, 20-year-old Sadiq Bey, 20-year-old Sekou Doumbouya, 26-year-old Jeremy Grant, 23-year-old Sufi Mihailuk, 23-year-old Josh Jackson, just a bunch of young guys out there playing hard and giving them something to root for throughout the duration of a game. Isaiah Stewart, who played really well in the two games against Boston, I thought another 20-year-old, 19-year-old. It's a far cry from what Pistons fans are used to the last few years, which is the bunch of veterans going for the eighth seed and not much to get behind. It's a different dynamic, and I think fans will be able to see that because if they're able to be competitive versus the good teams, the bad teams, and just give you something to root for the duration of 48 minutes, I think that's just what Detroit fans want, and they want to see a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think this is the first time in a long time you can kind of see some rays peeking through the cave.
Wait, what do you think of their offseason? Because they got blasted pretty hard for some of the signings they made. You look at Grant now, that one makes a ton of sense with all things considered. Mason Plumlee's been good so far. You know, maybe not, it doesn't make the most sense in the world roster-wise with some of the other pieces they have here. It's a ginormous lineup. Okafor's there. I mean, it's not like they committed big money to him, but look at this lineup. You look at the moves they made over the offseason. It's just big bodies everywhere, and it almost does remind you of what they had a couple years ago with Josh Smith, Greg Monroe, Andre Drummond. Drummond's out the door, trade last year. They didn't get a ton for him, but you're right. I mean, this team looks fun. Love the draft picks. Hayes has struggled so far. Sadiq Bey looks awesome. You know, almost someone that the Celtics might regret not drafting with the way Aaron Nesmith's situation has gone. And then you mentioned Isaiah Stewart.
On that,
guy I love.
Real quick, on that, I had heard that the Pistons possibly were going to get Aaron Nesmith if the Celtics didn't.
I don't know what to say about that one yet. Wait till he plays. But you don't love a guy not being able to play right away. But what do you think of what the Pistons have been doing so far? What's it toward? What was your reaction to the offseason, how it's gone so far?
I think like most, it was confusing at first because the week that free agency and the draft and all that stuff opened, spent the first 4 days looking like they were going to do a complete rebuild. They looked like, I mean, they traded away Bruce Brown. They traded away Luke Kennard. Before draft week, they only had the number 7 pick, and then they left the draft with 3 first-round picks and a second-round pick. So the vibe was like, oh, this is going to be a complete teardown. And then the next day comes free agency, and they sign Jeremy Grant, Josh Jackson, Mason Plumlee. And then
there's money flying everywhere.
Yeah, money flying everywhere, man. And I think it got lost, the message that had been preached for so long. Well, not for so long, but prior to all that, was that the Pistons wanted to be competitive, but while building for the future. And I had written, like, I understood nationally why people were confused or whatever, but I think now, like, we're seeing exactly the plan. They have been in every single game that they've played to date, but they haven't won. So you're not having this culture of, like, if you don't have Jeremy Grant, Mason Plumlee, this team probably has 3 or 4 20-point losses, 30-point losses. And that's not really kind of the taste you want to leave young players with as they're getting into the NBA and you're trying to build this from the ground up. I think you asked me a 1-point loss as much for your future as a 20-point loss in terms of draft positioning, but a 1-point loss versus a 20-point loss makes you feel a little bit better about yourself, especially when it comes against a team like the Celtics who has championship aspirations. So I think we're seeing it now, or at least what I tried to write and portray to people, that this team's not going to win a lot of games. But when they're going to, the way they wanted to rebuild was by being in games. And I think we're seeing, like, point in case, this first 6-7 games, like I said, they've been in every single game. They only have one win. And I don't think anybody in that locker room is hanging their head too low, because I think if you ask them, they feel like they probably should have won 3 or 4 of them. But there are limitations on the roster, like 3-point shooting, even though they shot well last night. That was really the first time they shot fairly well this season. But there are limitations that hold you back from winning a lot of games. So it's worked out. They put together, I mean, we could be talking about at the end of the year, maybe the best tank job in NBA history. If the Pistons lose, their average margin of loss is like less than 10, but they have only 15 wins. Like, that's much better than what Philly did. Philly's still recovering from all those years of losses. The foundation, kind of the taste in that organization is still weird. Guys still leave and guys still come and go. It's still not perfect. They have two guys that everybody loves, but, like, they haven't won anything. They're still trying to figure it out. Detroit wanted to be competitive while building for the future, and they're in the process of doing that.
Well, I'm impressed so far. They almost have a fan in me in terms of what they're doing and how they look early on. I love the young players there, and they were a fun watch over the weekend. I think there's been some of the most enjoyable Celtics games I've watched so far to start this year. The way they just went out there and attacked, it was almost reminiscent of those early Celtics rebuild years, just the pace and intensity with which they played. So they'll be an interesting watch for people this year, probably more fun than people expected. I think there's definitely going to be a thin line between a lottery team and a playoff team with the 10 playoff spots this year. So they're going to kind of be towing that line. But so far at 1-4, you're right. Like, they'll be among those bottom teams to have a chance for the number one pick in a pretty good draft. Before we get you out of here, I want to do some music. We got some strange, saddening news at the same time in MF Doom's passing. The fact that it was on Halloween and then announced on New Year's Eve was strange, but kind of befitting of an artist who was mysterious and elusive and almost mythical in a way in MF Doom. I saw you have a poster back there, a million records behind you. I'm sure you have some of his records. I got the Mad Villainy one over here. But I, you know, I'm not going to call myself a day one or anything like that, because I only just started listening to him in probably 2017, 2018. People put me onto him, and the last 2-3 years I've been listening to him a ton. So, you know, when he passed, I kind of had an extra hit on me, because the last 2-3 years I was just listening to all his work for the first time and really becoming familiar with it. But what's your connection to him? How did you respond to the death on New Year's Eve?
Yeah, the connection was, so, like, I've always been into, I grew up in kind of the blog era of rap. So, like, Two Dope Boys, All Hip Hop, gosh, now there's, like, none that I use, so, like, I can't remember them, but, like, Two Dope Boys specifically, like, so they would post, like, obviously, like, mainstream stuff, but they'd also post, like, underground stuff. And Two Dope Boys is still around and does great stuff. So if anybody's listening to this and, like, wants to find new artists to listen to, but you're into, like, kind of more rappity rap stuff, like, Two Dope Boys is a great website to check out. But yeah, so, like, I would always be on there and just like looking for new music. And they had, so I think Mad Villainy came out in 2004.
Yep.
So this was probably 2006, which was my first year of high school, that I like came across Mad Villainy. And I actually, my best friend, Sam, who actually works for Rock Nation, he's like Meek Mill's tour manager.
Funny story on that in a second, but keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I can't wait. He had a cousin who like used to like be able to get like Burns. Like he was early on the, he had a cousin that was early on, like if people remember LimeWire, and all like the torrent sites that you could get like music legally. So he had a cousin that was good at that. So we would like get CDs, and like me and him had a business in like middle school and high school where we would sell, we'd like, people would ask for CDs, like actual albums or like mixed CDs, and we'd burn them and sell them for like $2. But yeah, we came across MF Doom like early in those Stone Throw days, like 2006. Fell in love with it, like never heard anything like it. I was a huge wrestling fan, so like the mask got me. And then just the way he rhymed and like the beats were like ridiculous. And like we were both big J Dilla fans, so it was like part of that ilk too. So yeah, ever since then you go back and listen to stuff before, and then I just followed ever since. So I was pretty early on it, but that was just kind of a product of being very into music at like 13 and 14 and knowing where to go to find like very obscure hip hop like that. But yeah, also on his death, yeah, it was sad story. Like, so my girlfriend had got me a Christmas gift that had just arrived. It was late, obviously. I'm sure a lot of people got late gifts. And I just like put it on, tried it on. I was wearing it and like all super excited. And then like I got a text that he passed, and I was just like, didn't really like talk for
New Year's Eve. I mean, I know it was a weird New Year's Eve and like no one was really doing anything, but you know, you're trying to do something fun or just kind of relax at least that night. And that really bummed you out. Like,
yeah, same.
Yeah. Like, and again, it was so fitting of this mysterious, elusive persona that he had over the years to pass away on Halloween and have no one know about for 2 months. I mean, in this age especially, where like anybody could have leaked that out around him, that's just kind of the life he lived. He was so elusive that no one probably even knew outside of his wife to be able to leak that.
Right, and he's across the pond in London. So... His collaborators stateside were used to not getting in touch with him, because like you said, the elusiveness. Yeah, man, it's sad, because to me he's the most creative artist ever in hip hop. Like aside from the mask and the mystique. Like the way he rhymed, I mean, like food is like ridiculous. It's literally everything on the surface sounds like food references, but it's like deeper than that if you like listen or like have the lyrics in front of you. Like it's just the skits he would have leading into songs, the samples, the beats, like it was just so raw. Nobody did anything like that. Nobody sounded like him. Everybody that knew about him appreciated him and saw him as one of the best. It's sad because, you know, there's like, you want your favorite artist to always make music, and now he's not, like, there's no, I mean, I'm sure there probably might be stuff that comes out that he recorded. I'd imagine he's sitting on a lot of unreleased music, but it's like, you always envision your favorite artist to make music forever. So like, that was tough. Like you're going to have to live with what you got and make the most of it.
Fairly young too, at 49. Like, you know, he lived a life, but, you know, way, way younger than you would want one of your favorite people to pass away there. And he had a tough life. His son passed away in the last few years. Obviously his brother passed away very early in his career, and, you know, went through a ton of challenges in his life, and obviously had a health battle at the end, of course, too. No, we don't know why he died, but I look at him, and you talk about some of the things that made him so great. The technical aspect, and for people who love rap, like the technical aspect is always going to be something that if you bring it on that end, you know, there's going to be awesome respect. And he clearly was the best rhymer ever. Like, it's not even close. I was looking through some of his best lyrics ever, and he threw in like a volcano in Iceland as part of like a rhyme scheme.
Yeah.
And like he would just make these diversions. And I think what was so interesting too, you talk about like some of the content of food. And what stuck out to me about that one too is how like on the surface it would always be the persona, the villain, almost narrating like his own adventures of this villain, you know, whether it was him or a character that he was playing. But then mm-hmm. you would have these short diversions like deep fried friends into some more personal stuff. Or whether he was rapping about his short time in jail or just like these little moments where he'd reveal a little bit about, you know, Daniel Dumeal rather than MF Doom. But it would just be a flash and then he'd be right back to the villain. Like he only would let you into a hint of who he was, but enough to like keep you interested and keep you like intrigued by that.
I agree. No, that's a great point. That's the way he tucked things into his rhymes. Aside from like what you said, like he would throw personal tidbits in there, but like even the humor, like he's one of the funniest, his lingo, like some of the words he would use. Like every word seemed strategic and every word was like, you think he's going to say this, but then he says, I'm trying to think, there's one in Mad Villainy, where it's like clearly the rhyme should have been butter, but it's like I'd have to, now it's gonna bother me, but
that
it's
makes
like
me think of the one
with something
that makes me think of the one where he
and
puts,
it doesn't rhyme
where he puts booze in for where you would expect bitches.
Yeah, that too, like there's, and it's like it won't rhyme, but it's like you're not going to be able to predict what he's saying. And like that's genius. The butter one's gonna bother me because it was so like butter would have rhymed perfect, would make
sense. We'll put it in afterwards in the lyrics afterward on the screen here. What was your favorite song by him if you had to pick one?
I mean, I love Doomsday on Operation Doomsday.
That's a great one. That was probably
I love accordion. I love Rhinestone Cowboy. I love Strange Ways. Absolutely off Born Like This. Next Level, King Ghidra. He doesn't even rap on there, I don't think. It's just a ridiculous beat. Other people rap on it. Phasers off King, like it's just too, yeah, man. Like it's I couldn't do a top 10.
There's some really good ones on the Victor Vaughn album too from 2004. Man. And like you think, I just realized this the other day, he released Mad Villainy, Food, and the Victor Vaughn album all in the same year in 2004. I mean, there's never been a year like that for an artist in hip hop history.
No, because I think, again, it always goes back to people that know, to those people who were checking for it and were familiar, like those are three classics, and like to drop three classics in 1 year, like I think like DMX like probably did two in 1 year. There's a couple artists who did like two in 1 year, but like on that level, that like shook up what people knew as like the underground, like that was unfathomable. And to, I mean, Mad Villainy was, I think the, like it's always the one that people are familiar with go to, but I try to bring in other stuff like Victor Vaughn, but I think with Mad Villainy, that's like the epitome of like an underground rap classic. Like it's the most obscure thing. It's short. The beats are wild. The rhymes are wild, but it's like so perfect. And it's like the epitome of obscurity. Like if anybody asks, what does obscure mean? So it's Mad. It's a picture of his shadowy face on the Mad Villainy cover.
And you'll never have an artist like him again. It's just impossible the way the industry works now, the way social media has taken over a lot of, you know, the driving force of music. Like you can't be that obscure and make it now, especially with all the artists that you're competing with for attention. And like, there'll never be another MF Doom. There just can't be.
No, there can't be, because when you do it, everybody knows who you're copying off. Like he was the first. He did it so well that there can't be another.
I will say, you know, and I love, well, we're going to wrap this up here, but I love that you kind of bring that perspective of someone who growing up on that. You know, I obviously didn't get to do that, but Freddie Gibbs, and Mad, kind of carrying the torch of Mad Villainy, is something that feels similar. Not quite the same, but inspired by close. And, you know, carries that torch. So I'm going to keep following that. Look for the third edition of that trio. And you probably would have, did you ever think there would be a Mad Villainy follow-up when you think about, like, oh, could there have been more music? Did you expect there to be a Mad Villainy follow-up at some point?
So, like, I'm a super, like, nerd with that stuff. And, like, I found, like, I think Madlib has admitted that it's been done for years.
Wow.
They just couldn't agree on, like, when it would come out. I always held out hope that we would get a Madlib, Freddie Gibbs, MF Doom album at some point. I always held out hope that those three would get together and just do it. And, like, I know Freddie and Madlib did an interview, and Freddie was, like, teasing Doom. He's like, he can't rap better than me. He's like, oh, just talking mad shit. And I was like, I wonder if they would ever do it. And maybe they did it, and it's in the tuck, and nobody's talked about it. But, yeah, man, that's one that as a massive fan of both. I love Freddie, and I love Doom. And I love Madlib, but I always held out hope that we would get that one, a mush of a Freddie and Doom on Madlib beats would be, that would change things. Yeah.
I'm checking now. Everyone had done a tribute for MF Doom at this point who had some sort of connection to him, but still, I haven't seen anything from Madlib, and he's another guy who's kind of elusive. He'll do it in some way when the time is right and in his own, you know, personal way tribute.
Yeah.
But he is James Edwards III. You can follow all his Pistons action at theathletic.com. Go get a subscription. There's probably some sort of promo page people can go through for you. Do you have anything like that to throw out there?
If you click on the story and you're not a subscriber, there will be something on the story I'm sure there will be some promo when you click on the story that will allow you to get a little bit of a discount. I don't know exactly what it is right now, but in most cases, if you don't have a subscription and you click on the story, there will be one right there for you with the option to subscribe. And for people that aren't familiar, like if you subscribe to a James Edwards story or a Jay King story or a Jared White story, like you get access to all of the Athletic, basketball, any sport, any team, any city. Like it's not just that team or that story or that city. It's everything the Athletic offers, which is we cover pretty much every single team in North America. And if you're a Premier League soccer fan, that too. So, yeah.
All right. He is at JL Edwards, three I's, the third, JL Edwards, III. We'll have him on again to talk about Detroit rap sometimes. That's something we didn't have enough time for, but I can't wait to hear what you have to say about all of that. This is Dome Theory. We'll talk to you next week.